Hi, Mike.
Yes, hello.
Well, hello. How are you? This is Joe Hunter.
Hey, Joe. Great to be with you today. I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing really good. I only have one interview to do today. I hope you're holding.
Oh, great deal. Are
you holding up? I always feel for you guys when you're doing interviews and things. I hope you're holding up all right.
Yeah, no, holding up well. I'm sorry I'm a couple minutes late. I was just finishing up another interview and called in a couple minutes late. I hope I didn't mess up your schedule.
Mike, you're fine. You're awesome. It's okay.
Good deal.
Not doing anything. Listen, I just wanted to say and I kind of apologize. I wasn't all that familiar with your book. And I were you guys on with Dr. Dobson on Focus on the Family one time?
Yep, I sure was.
You were?
A few years ago, and then they reran it just last August, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm making my way through the book, and I have to tell you that it's very convicting. What do people say to you, you know, when they first meet you, and what do they say about your book? What's your reaction?
Well, you know, it's kind of it's an interesting deal. You know, I'm getting the chance to meet a lot of people just through speaking engagements across the country, and you know, most people are. It's this weird mix, right, of thankfulness. It's kind of like you've been rebuked for something that you know you shouldn't have been doing anyway, and you're both thankful for it, but kind of like, oh, wow, it didn't feel good to get rebuked. You know, it's that weird mix.
You know what I think it is? If it was me, it would be, thank God it's you, Mike, and God didn't ask me to do something like that.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. I think it's just been a lot of fun, you know, and it's been really great to sort of allow this story to continue to be told and to see how God's using it and to convict people and to motivate them to care for others and to love others. It's just really, really good. It's really moving.
Let me ask you a detailed question right here. Now, how did you come about with Under the Overpass? I mean, it's kind of obvious because that's where you slept, right?
Yeah, no, yeah, it is. Sam and I did. We lived most of those months under the bridges trying to stay dry and you know, trying to stay warm, et cetera. So it's very visual and graphic in the sense that it positions us very clearly out on the streets underneath of the bridge or underneath of the overpass. But I actually, you know, I was sitting in a coffee shop one night working on a chapter for the book and kind of thinking about what I wanted to call the book as I was trying to compile all the stories, et cetera. And I was trying to, you know, in a sense, have a play on the words, the idea of the Passover and the idea that we were literally passed over again and again and again. And obviously the Old Testament and the New Testament references to the Passover feast and the Jewish feasts and the ceremonies there. But it just kind of went from Passover to under and the overpass and Passover overpass and, you know, that kind of idea. And then under the overpass stuck. So.
Wow, that man, you're something. I never would have thought of that. That's pretty cool.
It was one of those moments where it was just like, okay, that's it. Yeah, that'll do.
I got to tell our listeners that the book is new and expanded, right? You got some new things
exactly.
In there, right? Okay, what's expanded about it, Mike?
Yeah, well, it is a new and expanded updated edition. It just came out, as a matter of fact, last week.
Mm-hmm.
So brand new version of it. And what we've done is Multnomah was gracious enough to decide to print a 5th anniversary edition. So the book originally came out in 2005, and now this new edition has come out in 2010. And there's a couple new stories in there, things that, because of page restrictions, I wasn't able to put into the original version of Under the Overpass. And as well, there's also a brand new foreword from author Francis Chan. He's the author of the book Crazy Love, and he is a good friend of my wife's and mine, and so he was gracious enough to offer to write the foreword for this new version. So a new foreword from Francis Chan. And as well, at the end of the book, there's what's called an author interview, so several questions that have come up along the way as I've had the chance to speak and to continue to write. So I address some of those larger questions at the end. And then also an epilogue chapter, which is basically looking back at the last 5 years and sort of tracing what has happened in the last 5 years in my own life and in Sam's life and kind of updating the readers on where we are today after this whole journey and this experience several years ago. So really excited, brand new edition, updated and expanded, and a 5th anniversary edition.
I would say, by all means, read Francis Chan's foreword before you jump right into the book, because that way you kind of get on the ground that it's convicting. And it's a good place to be before you dive into the book, I'll tell you that right now. So.
Well, thanks so much. Francis is just a great guy.
And I've been looking at some of his videos, and I wasn't that familiar with him either, Mike, so you taught me a lot in the last couple of hours. I'll tell you, it's been pretty amazing. But do you remember everything that happened to you?
You know, in a lot of ways, yes. Some of the details, I think, are you know, faded a little bit. I mean, memory just, you know, I don't have a photographic memory. I wish I did, but I don't. So, you know, things have faded a lot. But, you know, there are times where I'll find myself driving or, you know, sitting on a plane flying somewhere or making dinner and, you know, just thinking about some of the people that we met, thinking about some of the places we slept. You know, Danae and I live in Vancouver, B.C. right now, so in a large city. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are on the streets. And so, you know, it's interesting to think, okay, yeah, Sam and I were there. We were in that place. How am I going to respond now when I see someone who's on the streets, et cetera? Those kinds of things, it's very present to me, and it's had such a formative and shaping impact on who I am and, you know, the things that I'm involved in and the things that I'm an advocate for. I mean, I serve on the board of directors at World Vision United States. The fact that I'm there is because I believe that we have, we as Christians in particular and people in general, have to be mindful of the least of these, and we have to be concerned about the people who are at the bottom rungs of our socioeconomic ladder, and how are we going to respond with compassion and kindness and care and love, et cetera. So, you know, this whole experience has had a hugely transformative and shaping effect on me, and literally has set the trajectory that I find myself on currently. And so it's just had a massive influence on me, there's no doubt.
Mike, kind of tongue-in-cheek, I know you were thinking about that when you decided to go do this adventure about living on the streets. You must have been thinking, oh, we'll write a book, you know, it'll be a life-changing, it'll be a great experience and all that, and it'll be rich. Is that what happened?
No, definitely no. Not. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, looking back, it's just kind of like, how did this whole thing unfold? I mean, this idea started when I was a 20-year-old freshman at, or not an 18-year-old freshman at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And I just kind of realized, gosh, I'm living a hypocritical life. Like, this is a Christian college. I'm going to the church that is a good church in Santa Barbara. I'm helping out with the youth group. I'm doing everything I think I ought to be doing. But then I began to realize, you know, when it comes down to loving my neighbor as myself, I don't love other people. I don't care about other people. What I really am all about is myself. I'm about making sure that my life is okay, that I'm doing what I want to do, et cetera, et cetera. Well, how does that square with the scriptures? How does that square with this thing called Christianity? How does that square with this command from Jesus to love your neighbor as yourself? Well, I flat out realized it doesn't. It doesn't square. It doesn't jive. It doesn't work. It's not harmonious. And so that was the beginning of this, like, really deep internal conviction that I need to figure out what this is about. Because if I'm going to say I believe this, I need to obey the tenets of it. I need to live as though it's true, not merely just talk about it. So that was the beginning and the genesis of this whole idea to go and to live on the streets and to become a homeless person and to enter into the homeless life as much as Sam and I could. There was, you know, no plan to write a book. It was really kind of one of these funny experiences where I had a friend who was writing for Multnomah, which is the company who ended up publishing Under the Overpass, and I found out that Multnomah was interested before Sam and I had even gone on the streets in potentially taking this into a book form. And I contacted Multnomah and, you know, talked with them and just kind of said, hey, look, you know, this is not about writing a book. This is about trying to find out what it means to love our neighbors as ourselves. So Sam and I need to have this journey and this experience before we can even begin to talk about turning it into a book. So let's table the conversation. When Sam and I get back from being on the streets, then we can reopen it and just kind of see what happens. But, you know, frankly, I didn't think there would be anything worth writing about. In a sense, we're going to be, you know, trying to survive for 5 months, eating out of trash cans and sleeping underneath the bridges. I didn't think there'd be anything that they would want to publish, right?
I kind of agree with you there, but you didn't know. But, you know, something, that thought that you had, that's like one of the most mature thoughts I think anybody you could ever have, and for you at a young age. I think most of us, if we have an inkling of something like that, we kind of brush it off. We kind of turn up the radio or something and keep on going and try to hope it doesn't follow us and chase us down, I think. I really do.
No, I think you're right. It's so much easier to do that, you know, and I think it's a whole lot easier to distract ourselves than to actually face up to what is going on internally, you know. But I think that's one of the true calls of Christianity, is to listen to that still small voice, those inklings that are happening inside of us, to listen to what God might be doing in us as he seeks to conform us to the image of his Son, and to be willing to say, yeah, okay, this growth and this transformation that I'm being brought through and carried through requires me to be willing to address what's going on in the depths of my being. And that's a hard call, that's incredibly overwhelming, that's very frightening, but I also think that that's the only true, narrow, hard path to transformation. That's the way to true life. And so, you know, yeah, it was one of those things where I think Sam and I both just began to realize, like, this is what God is doing in us. This is what we are being called toward. This is what we need to attend to, what we need to be open to, what we need to be, you know, listening to. And I think in many ways it would have been more dangerous to not do that.
Wow. Wow. That's an amazing statement there. Since you mentioned Sam, okay? I must say that Sam was not previous to this. He wasn't one of your buddies, because I think you ask all your buddies. I could just see this happen. Hey, got an idea. You know, and they're like, well, look at the time. I got to go study math. You know, I mean, so how did you and Sam get together?
You're exactly right. Yeah, you know, I did ask a lot of my friends at Westmont, and all very good friends. Many of them still in contact with today, and really good friends. Still, it was just, I think that God wasn't calling them to go on this journey with me. He wasn't calling us to go together. Many times I had conversations with them and just kind of said, yeah, hey, I think I'm going to go be homeless for a little while. What do you think? And it's like, I think I probably need to stay in school. And totally understand that. It's absolutely legitimate and totally fine. Sam and I actually met. It's kind of a funny story. Sam's older brother was attending University of California at Santa Barbara, and Danae, my wife, and Sam grew up together in the same small town in Oregon. So Danae was at Westmont attending classes there. Sam came down to Santa Barbara to visit his older brother at University of California, Santa Barbara, called up Danae, and they went out and had coffee. And then Danae told Sam about this experience that I was planning and this journey that I was planning to go live on the streets for 5 months in six different cities as a homeless person. Sam got really excited about it, came back to Westmont. He and I hung out and met the first time in February. And then by May, we were going on the streets together. So really, yeah, a really incredible story of how God kind of brought Sam and I together and gave him a similar vision and a similar passion and a similar desire to go and to journey on the streets. And so I'm so thankful for that. And I think both of us are. We realize that we probably wouldn't have survived this experience if it hadn't been for the other person.
Yeah. Well, for lack of a better word, that is pretty cool. And speaking of survival there, Mike, boy, this is like a million questions, you know, going through your head when somebody meets somebody like you, because you always want to know, well, what was the time, kind of what was your moment when you thought, that's it, I'm out of here, you know, I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, every night? Might have been every night, I don't know.
It was quite frequently, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I mean, there were definitely points where Sam and I were just like, dude, let's get out of here. Like, this is ridiculous. I mean, one evening in San Francisco, for example, I mean, we're sleeping in Golden Gate Park, and, you know, the cold fog rolls in off the Pacific Ocean. It starts to rain a little bit. All the fog is condensing on the trees above our head. The wind's blowing. It's about 40 degrees. Ooh. And as the wind's blowing, it's knocking all the condensed fog off of the trees. I mean, it's just pouring on us. We're completely soaked through. And we're, you know, we're both tired. It's the middle of the night. We're wet. We're cold. We're hungry. It's just like, this is lame. Let's get out of here. But then I think what kept us going again and again and again, as we felt like leaving, was the fact that, you know what, we are friends with people here in this city. They may be sleeping right next to us underneath the same bridge, for example, who don't have that luxury of choice that we do. They can't just choose to get off the streets in the way that we can. And in many ways, obviously, Sam's and my journey is artificial in that sense. We always knew it was going to end. We knew that we had chosen to put ourselves there in the way that most of the 3 million men, women, and children who are going to be on the streets this year in the United States don't choose it. And I think it was that fact and realizing, wow, okay, we have the luxury of choice to get out of here whenever we want to. This person doesn't. How can we learn about the reality of life on the streets? How can we learn about what's going on in these people's stories and these people's lives so that we can be advocates, so that we can help other people desire and become engaged with this situation and to help people ultimately to transition off of the streets and to love people in Christ's name? It was that motivation of realizing we have a responsibility to in a sense, learn as much as we can so that in whatever way we can, when we get back, we can help be advocates and be a voice for the least of these.
Now, you brought up a good point, because you always knew, you know, that you did. You had a light at the end of the tunnel. That must have been a gut-wrenching thought to think that the other people, you like you said, you're right there with your neighbors, and they don't. I don't know how you'd handle that.
Man. Yeah, no, it was very difficult, and I think that you hit it right on the head. You know, I mean, that's why I'm going to speak and to write about this experience. That's why I'm so excited about this brand new version of Under the Overpass that's just come out. That's why I'm continuing to seek to be a voice, because I think that a loving and compassionate and sustainable response to our world's great needs, whether they be international poverty issues or they be domestic poverty issues, is one of the truest ways that we can love our neighbors as ourselves, as Christians. Like, this is a key area in which we need to be involved as followers of Christ, I believe. And so, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it is gut-wrenching, and that's why I do what I do. That's why I speak. That's why I write. That's why I try and raise support. That's why I try and raise awareness. Et cetera, et cetera.
And most of those people have no idea that you're working so hard for them, do they? I'm sure they don't.
Really? I think a couple do, but yeah, really? Most don't, and that's fine. They don't need to know.
No, I know.
I get stories now and then, from people through the website, through undertheoverpass.com, or as I had the chance to meet people who have read Under the Overpass, and, it's just so encouraging to me to hear a story about, say someone who's never interacted with a homeless person before and is absolutely terrified or was terrified of homeless people, saying, you know what, I realized this guy who's panhandling outside of this store, he's just another human being, and I went and I bought him a sandwich and I gave it to him, and just to look in his eyes, how thankful he was and how much it meant to him, that changed my day, that changed my life. And when I hear stories like that, I'm just kind of like, okay, yeah, this is good stuff. Or when someone says, hey, I'm going to go to agrm.org, the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, I'm going to find out where my local rescue mission is, I'm going to get involved, I'm going to start volunteering, I'm going to start financially supporting, prayerfully supporting, volunteering, mentoring, etc. And when they get involved and they begin to see someone's life transformed because God is working through them in that place, that's good news. That's the good stuff. And I'm just kind of like, okay, yeah, this is what it's about. This is awesome.
It is awesome. Hey, Mike, is there a particular person that'll always, mean the most or stand out the most that you met?
Yeah, great question. We met tons of people on the streets.
Yeah.
And everybody had such a fascinating and a unique story. I mean, we met people who hadn't finished high school, and people who had PhDs. We met people who had been on the streets for 15 years, and people who had just arrived because they just got evicted from their apartment. They just lost their job last week, et cetera. So a huge variety of people and a huge variety of stories. I think one person, though, that certainly stands out is a guy named Rings. We met him in San Diego, California. Rings was a 50-something homeless man, and he lived in the cab of his pickup truck, an old beat-up pickup truck. And this guy just blew me away. What he did every month, took his Social Security check, cashed it, went to the grocery store and bought groceries, bought food, put them in the back of his pickup truck and the coolers that were in the back of his pickup truck, and then spend the rest of the month until all the food was gone driving around San Diego feeding other homeless people. He would, come into a park and call everybody over to him and, start barbecuing up some steak and some potatoes or some burritos in the morning, some eggs, frying up some eggs, et cetera, and just loving on people. And I'm just thinking to myself, now, wait a second, this guy could be, in an affordable housing unit. He could be living inside. He could be living, a more normal life, but he's not choosing to do that. Instead, he's choosing to live in the cab of his pickup truck and then use all the income that he has to buy food for other people. And I completely blown away by this, started talking to Rings, and come to find out he's a Christian. He had been an alcoholic for several years, and the moment he became a Christian, God had transformed his life, and he was no longer addicted to alcohol. I mean, that doesn't happen very often, but it did happen in Rings' case. And then he said, he started reading through the Bible and said, well, all I see in here is this idea that God has done great things for me. I need to love other people as a response to what God's done for me. And so this is Rings seeking to manifest that love of neighbor in a really tangible, very real way by meeting other people's needs, by providing food for them as they're on the streets. Just completely overwhelming. I'm just kind of like, this is unreal. This is so cool. How often do I think about love in some abstract kind of way? Like, wouldn't it be great if someday, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And here's Rings saying, nope, this person's hungry now, so I'm going to feed them. And that's what my neighbor as myself is, to assess their real, tangible needs in the moment and then to choose to respond with compassion, grace, kindness, love, and tangible meeting of needs.
In Rings, I'm sorry, Mike. Hey, Rings probably isn't even thinking about a reward. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, man, can you imagine how God is going to greet him? And he's probably not even thinking about that.
I mean, I think you're spot on. I think you're exactly right. I think, hey, he's not worried about what's going to be happening, 20 years from now when he's dead, or, how God's going to greet him into the kingdom. I think he's saying, look, the whole point of this is to love in deed and truth, not just with word. I think we need to be careful there. We need to understand that loving in Christ's name and loving our neighbors as ourselves is both word and deed, both deed and word. It's both of those together. You see this in the Gospels again and again and again. This is what Jesus is doing. He's proclaiming the coming kingdom of God with words and also healing the sick. He's providing people with food. He's proclaiming it in both word and deed and doing those two things together. I think that's exactly what Rings is all about, and I think it's a huge lesson for me, certainly, and probably for a lot of people.
Well, Mike, let me ask you this then. I'm in a church, right? And then, because there's probably a lot of people in churches that really kind of want to know, what could we do? How would you answer that if they really wanted to get involved and help out a neighborhood?
Yeah, several different thoughts. You know, I think we can do things as Christians and people within churches on an individual basis and on a moment-by-moment basis. I think when we see people who are in need, we can choose to respond with compassion and kindness. One of the best things that I found to do is to buy gift certificates to local fast food restaurants or coffee shops, et cetera. Carry those around in my wallet, our car, my wife's purse, et cetera. And as we see people who are in need, we're able to offer that to them, not assuming that they need it. Maybe they've eaten or they don't really want to eat at the place that we've bought a gift certificate for them at. But just offering it to them and saying, hey, maybe you'd like to go get a cup of coffee. Maybe you'd like to buy a sandwich, et cetera. That's a great way to be able to respond in a moment-by-moment basis. Or, for example, on a hot day in the summertime, buying some bottled water and, you know, attaching a soft, chewy granola bar with some tape, carrying those around in your car, and when you see people on the freeway, on-ramps and off-ramps, et cetera, being able to offer and to respond in that kind of way. Stepping it up a little bit or in a different sort of framework, I think that there are also ways that we can choose to be involved in our local rehabilitation centers. I've already mentioned the AGRM, the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions. Find out more at agrm.org. You can find your local rescue mission and choose to respond and choose to become involved, whether it be financially or prayerfully or as a volunteer, as a mentor to walk with and alongside of the men and the women who are in the rehabilitation programs there. It's a fantastic way to get involved and to be supportive of your local homeless shelter and rehabilitation center. And then another way, I think, as well, is choosing to become an advocate and choosing to use the means and the relationships and the networks that we have been given as Christians within our local communities to advocate on behalf of the least of these. So that can look like any number of things. For example, it might be seeking the minimum wage in our local areas to be more on par with what's called living wage. Now, I was in just north of Colorado, just north of Denver, in a town called Longmont a few years ago, meeting with the town council and several churches who had gotten together to form this kind of think tank meeting to say, hey, look, the minimum wage is less than, two times less what the living wage is here in our town. That means that a single mom of three kids has to work two minimum wage jobs, and she's not even going to be able to provide for basic living wage standards for her family. So seeking to, encourage local business owners and local employers to increase the amount that they're paying their lowest paid employees in order to help make ends meet for them so that there's less of a possibility of that person ending up on the streets as a homeless person. Or, for example, if you're a business owner, choosing to work again with your local rescue mission and say, hey, you know what, I'm willing to employ people who have graduated from your rehabilitation programs. I'm willing to employ them because I know that employment is one of the best ways to help people stay off of the streets, and consistent employment, supportive employment, et cetera, et cetera. So all kinds of ways to get involved. But I'm willing to bet that your listeners have creativity enough to be able to find out how can I plug in? How can I respond? God, what are you calling me to? And I encourage them to do that.
Ooh, that's a good idea right there, too. Mike, before I let you go, you probably heard of this program, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but I kind of like it, and I think it's caught on. It's called Undercover Boss. You ever seen that on Sunday nights? You probably don't watch TV. But
I haven't actually. Tell me about it.
These bosses of these companies, I mean CEOs of like waste management and a cable company and different entertainment companies and stuff like that, what they do is they go in disguise and they pretend like they're somebody who's applying for a job or they're making, and of course they have cameras there, but they go down to where the people who are doing, cleaning up the garbage and doing the jobs. One guy with Chiquita last week, I think it was out in the field in California because they do a salad thing. And boy, but it's amazing because they had no idea what people in their company go through, what they have to sacrifice to do this job, what they have to do the job with, how much money they make, what they're sacrificing. Just it's almost like a common theme. But here's somebody that was sitting at the top office in the corner that didn't know what was going on. And so putting themselves in those shoes, they've said, almost without fail. And I don't know if the guy that does this is a Christian. I almost think he is. But they all are very empathetic. With the people that work there and go, we got to make some changes. Isn't that interesting?
I think it's absolutely interesting, and I think that you're spot on there, and I think they've really hit on something in that TV show. When we are willing to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, when we're willing to see the world through someone else's eyes, it transforms how we understand ourselves. It transforms how we understand our responsibility to others, and I think it transforms how we understand our responsibility as Christians in this world. That's the idea of empathy. That's the idea of, I think, at the core, what Jesus is talking about, loving your neighbor as yourself.
Oh, boy.
how do you do that? I think it requires imagination. It requires what the Apostle Paul talks about in Philippians 2, 3, and 4, when he says, consider not only your own interests, but also the interests of others. We have to be willing to consider what it would be like to see the world from that perspective. And you know what? That's exactly what this whole journey that Sam and I went on is all about. That's what Under the Overpass is about, is trying to enter into someone else's shoes and to see the world from their perspective.
Well, Mike, I've taken a lot of your time. Do you know where you're going? I mean, you're a young guy, and you're so mature and everything. I mean, you just like got it made. You could just sit and rest.
No, not at all. No rest for the weary, right? No. My wife and I were grad students up here in Vancouver, British Columbia, at a place called Regent's College. Getting the likes of J.I. Packer and Bruce Waltke and Gordon Fee and Eugene Peterson, just incredible people. And I think both of us are hoping probably to become professors. We love to teach, and we love to sort of create educational opportunities for students that are outside of the typical ivory tower structure, kind of along the lines of Under the Overpass, trying to put people in situations that stretch and test theory and sort of force the question, okay, if we really believe this, what does that mean? And how do we respond? What do we do? What does it mean to tangibly, actively, really love people in Christ's name? So, yeah, I think that's what we're hoping for. But, gosh, I mean, who can tell, right? You never know what's going to come around the next bend on the road. So
you're qualified to
and trust and see.
You're qualified to say that and mean it. I'll tell you that right now. That's amazing. And I really appreciate the time very, very much. And we'll have a good time airing your thoughts, okay?
And,
oh,
so
Mike,
really
let me ask you, before I forget, I almost always forget this. Can we pray for you? How can we pray for you? You got an idea?
Yeah, gosh, thanks. You know what? I think one of the things that I'd really appreciate prayer for, and this is really exciting, Under the Overpass is actually being made into a movie, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
Completely overwhelming, really unexpected, very exciting. Also really complicated, too, trying to figure out, okay, how do we maintain the integrity of the message and transfer it into this different medium, through, it's always interesting trying to take a book and turn it into a movie, and trying to figure out how to do that well. So I'd really appreciate prayer for that, just that I would walk wisely and humbly and faithfully in the midst of this.
Man, you thought being homeless was scary. Now you're really getting into it, boy, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
It's
overwhelming, to say the least.
Wow.
Very exciting, but overwhelming, too. So just, that I'd be faithful in it, I think would be a huge prayer request.
Okay, you got it, Mike. Thank you very much. God bless you. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks so much. You as well. Have a great day.
Okay, Mike. God bless.